Bankless Nation, it's the second week of May. David, it is weekly roll-up time. You ready for this?
I'm absolutely ready for this. And we're going to go super fast this week because that's kind of the week that it is. First up, Gary sends his fifth Wells notice this week. Who got the nasty gram this week? It's not a crypto company, so the crypto army is growing by one. Joe Biden says he will veto extremely important crypto legislation right before election season, and Trump has a thought on that. Bold strategy coming out of the Biden administration. And also, we got a number of signals to say that the bull market is not over. We have some tides that are turning in the bullish favor, so we'll talk about that. And also, Frentech launched their token, Mode Network launched their token, a roll-up. Spans between Bitcoin and Ethereum. Got a bunch of new network launches this week, and we're going to get to all of these details and more. But first, before we get into prices, we've got to talk about our friends and sponsors over at Transporter, a brand new bridging app called Transporter. Using Chainlink's CCIP in the background to help you securely transfer your assets, ETH, LINK, USDC, between all of the different chains, of which there are three more this week. So you can try out transporter.io. Link in the show notes if you want to securely transfer and track tokens across all of your blockchains.
This is like Jason Statham taking your assets from one chain and putting them on another chain.
That is
chain.
Such a niche That's reference. Cool this
is. Someone out there got it. All right, let's get to the prices. Thanks to Kraken for providing these glorious charts, the beautiful charts, but the direction is unfortunately a bit... Wait, are we up or down on the
Bitcoin,
week?
Bitcoin's up on the week. Bitcoin is
Wait, really?
Up 5.3% on the week.
I don't feel happier this week, David. It doesn't feel like it.
Hang on, we haven't got to ETH
up.
Yet. We haven't got to ETH
okay.
yet. Bitcoin started the week at $59,000. It is currently at $61,500, up 5.3% at the week. ETH price, basically flat. Started the week, $2,950. We are ending the week right below $3,000, up 0.5%. Counts as flat. And of course, the total crypto market cap, $2.39 trillion, under $2.4 trillion.
Would you say this is still feeling doldrums-y? Like, it feels like it's kind of, you know,
yeah.
There's some
so far,
malaise
we've got
on
like
the market
six,
right now.
6 weeks of just like not exciting, down, flat-ish.
So while this general malaise is going on, the layer two projects continue to build. And thanks to Mantle for this layer two update today, David. You know, there's now 95 projects on L2 Beat.
And that's just the ones that we know about.
95 different layer twos. And you're absolutely right. That's just the ones that we know about. This is Chow saying, in other words, there are probably at least several hundreds, possibly thousands of layer twos right now. And I think there's a big question for crypto is this just like an infrastructure boom? Like, how sustainable are all of these layer twos? I know you and I have always taken the vantage point that like the answer to the question of how many layer twos will there be is sort of similar to trying to answer the question, how many websites will there be?
Right. How many blogs will there be? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. As many as the market finds like useful and deems fit. What's your take on these numbers here? Do you think this is sustainable?
Well, in the short term, no. In the long term, yes. And I think there's going to be a theme, especially when we get to the announcement section of this roll-up, is like, well, we are getting more roll-ups this week, but we're also getting more specialized roll-ups. And so one of the reasons why there will be like N number of roll-ups is because they are learning to become extremely niche and extremely specific and finding different corners of the internet in which like a roll-up is actually useful and justified. So yeah, we'll talk about that.
Let's talk more about the markets again and see how long these doldrums will last. Because there's actually, David, some bullish signs on the horizon. You called it in the intro, the tide is beginning to change. So a few things that are different that we should emphasize this week. Number one, I don't know if you saw this chart. This is Thomas.
I love
M2
this chart.
M2 money supply has flipped positive. Here it is. What are we looking at? And can you describe this for like Bankless listeners and viewers on YouTube, what we're looking at and what M2 is actually measuring?
So we are looking at a chart from 2019 up until this very moment right now of the percentage growth of M2 money supply. So when there is a tiny blue bar that's above the line, that means we are growing by a percentage. And then if it's below the line, it actually means that M2 supply is decreasing. M2 money supply is called broad money supply. So like if you pull out your wallet and you have like a $1 bill, that is M0. M2 is after all of the, you know, 10-to-1 fractional reserve of the commercial banking sector. It's after all of like private money has been created. And so it's a very broad measure of circulating money. And it's generally why it's important. It's generally the underlying common denominator that frequently priced as capital assets.
Yeah, and so, it's like, you know that meme where you see Jerome Powell in the money printer?
Yeah,
that's what
M2
basically is. This is
well,
M2.
Not when Jerome Powell in the money printer prints $1, that turns into like $10 in M2. Mm. And so it's like leveraged just because of like the leverage of the commercial banking system. M2 is like where people get the money in their accounts to go buy assets. That M2 money supply flipped negative at the end of 2022 because of the Federal Reserve hiking interest rates and all the capital destruction in both like Bitcoin, crypto, stock market, all the capital assets went down, right? Houses stopped being sold.
For people who can't see, before that, it was mega.
It was big. It was extremely big. It was very, very big. So like M2 money supply was growing 25% like for a year, which is large, which is very, very large. So M2 money supply was getting smaller basically throughout 2023 and into 2024. In the last week, M2 money supply flipped positive, as in M2 supply of money out there is growing for the first time in like a year and a half, if 18 months. And Bitcoin generally, crypto assets generally are like debasement hedges, and M2, the growth of M2 money supply is basically the thing that props up, especially the long tail of assets out there, which is definitely what crypto is.
So for the first time in a couple of years, M2 has flipped positive. The money printer is on. You remember that take I was telling you from Arthur Hayes, I think a couple of roll-ups ago, where he was just basically like, April's a wash. I'm going to sell. Like, it's just like, we're going down in April. And he called this like at the end of March and beginning of April. He has now flipped bullish.
Oh, right? Great.
It's like one month later.
It's May now.
And this part of the reason why is he says this: make no mistake, by reducing the rate of quantitative tightening from $95 billion to $60 billion per month. That's a thing that happened, by the way. They've reduced quantitative tightening. The Fed is essentially adding $35 billion per month of dollar liquidity. Okay, so quantitative tightening has eased. And in other words, this is quantitative easing, money supply expansion, mm-hmm. by another word. And this is part of the reason that Arthur has flipped bullish. And he's not saying it'll happen overnight, but he's basically saying we're back to more liquidity, back to money printing, back mm-hmm. to like how things were trending in 2020. Now, of course, we're probably not going to see a COVID level stimulus,
right.
But that for Arthur makes him very bullish on the crypto asset class.
If you look at the total supply of M2 money out there, not just the change in direction of its growth, M2 money supply grew just absolutely massively post-COVID. That's like really what the effect of COVID was a massive growth in M2. And then we jacked up interest rates and all that money went into money market funds. But if you look, like the supply of M2 money didn't go away. There's still a ton of M2 money out there. There's just not in the long tail. As M2 money is growing now and people going on risk on, like all of that money that's still we still printed a bunch of money, it's still out there. Now it's giving like more and more permission to go out on the long tail. So that's like the first changing of the tides. Second, pretty unrelated to M2 money, but Grayscale GBTC saw its first ever inflows last Friday. And so the actual amount of Bitcoins in the Grayscale GBTC ETF went up, which is crazy because like there's so much already Bitcoin in there. The fees are super high. People are still trying to figure out why there's more Bitcoin in Grayscale than typically what would be expected. People are learning like why are people buying Grayscale over anything else? Still haven't found that answer. The crazy thing is it also went up on Monday as well. So Grayscale had 2 days in a row of inflows into the Grayscale GBTC ETF.
So I kind of want to ask the question, though. What about just global Bitcoin ETF inflows, right? So, like, I don't know if we can really explain why Grayscale had an up week, but are we getting an up week on just global Bitcoin ETFs?
Last week, we definitely had net outflows, kind of like one of the biggest net outflows. This week, we have pretty strong net inflows. Kind of hard to measure it, but looking like maybe $50 to $100 million a day of net inflows into the Bitcoin ETFs. Last week, there was a very large net outflow of $570 million. So the average day this week has been like $100 to $200 million of net inflows. So this week, net inflows. Last week, net outflows. The week before that, net outflows. The week before that, net outflows. And then before that, it was all inflows. So yes, this week, there has been a turning of the tide of net inflows into the Bitcoin ETFs.
the last tide turning I think we want to talk about is stablecoin market supply is going up. And this is something that Jim Bianco, it's like one of his theses he turned you and I onto, which is basically we're not going to get a bullish like crypto market until you start to see stablecoin market cap and stablecoin supply going up, because that's a representation of how much liquidity there is flowing from the fiat system into crypto. And sure enough, the market cap of stablecoins was down during the bear market. And now it is starting a trajectory, an ascent up.
We're within striking distance of all-time highs of stablecoin supply.
Yes. Here's the tweet around this. This is exactly what you want to see, and it's very important metric to monitor. As long as we continue to see stablecoin inflows, our coins will go up. The stablecoin market cap has grown by $30 billion year-to-date and is now about $19 billion away from last cycle's peak. So this is another bullish indicator. Don't sleep on this one. Mm-hmm. This is a nice gradual kind of ascent that you'd expect to see. And as long as that number is going up, I think the crypto bull market is still on.
More changing tides here, but this was more specifically for Solana rather than the entire macro market. This is a tweet out of Dan Smith from Blockworks Research, who's talking about the fees being paid to the Solana layer one. And Solana MEV over the last like month or so has actually surpassed Ethereum MEV. Total economic value of transaction fees. Solana is still below Ethereum, but like still putting in, like you actually can see it on the chart, which is like that's the first time for Solana. This started, of course, in December of 2023 with the rise of like Solana Summer. But you can definitely start to see like Solana showing up on the charts with fee supply, fee structures. So the fee market in Solana, very, very strong. This is something that like we were saying like last cycle is like Solana has to get to the point of having like sustainable fees. And this is what this looks like.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. This number impresses me because something that you and I have said from the very beginning, which I think is true, and we should evaluate more layer one chains, this is blockchains. What do blockchains do? Blockchains sell blocks.
Solana selling blocks.
How do you know whether someone is purchasing the blocks? You have to look at the fee revenue. And the fee revenue comes from two sources, either transaction fee revenue.
Metric.
Right, or the ordering of the blocks, which is MEV. And so Solana is just not making that much with respect to like fee revenue itself, but is making a ton with respect to ordering of the blocks. And that's actually impressive. I think if they can sustain this moving forward and how long they can sustain this, this is kind of like flipping into a big bullish indicator to me from a fundamentals perspective. A few things that I like would look for next as Solana continues to mature. It's like, one is, what's the sustainability of this? Right,
fee revenue to issuance ratio, right?
Well, first of all, sustainability, not profitability of block space, but I'm just saying like there's going to be a lot of high throughput blockchains that will compete against this, basically. So you've got your Monad coming online, you've got the Move ecosystem, you've got other layer twos that are going to like maybe
contested,
try to commoditize this
corner of crypto.
Yeah, but then I think secondly, fee burn, right? Because just like what you want to see is that the fee revenue, the blockchains that you're selling, exceeds the cost, which is like issuance. In our world, that's issuance. I know some people disagree with that, but issuance is kind of like a cost if you're not staking in the network. Ideally, you have profitable block space, and they implement some sort of fee burn that delivers this MEV back to the holders of SOL. It's sort of there to stakers, right? With Jito and that sort of thing, like you can get a portion of this MEV, I believe, but it's not quite as clear how this MEV flows to kind of like the average ordinary Solana staker SOL holder. And then lastly, I actually think MEV can become a problem for networks too, right? If it gets distributed.
Unaddressed MEV, yeah.
If it gets distributed to kind of like a...
MEV, unchecked MEV is a massive centralization force.
It can be, right? Yeah. And so that's another thing that we'll want to monitor long term, but good signals, I think, for Solana.
Yeah. So if I wanted to move the goalposts, MEV to validators, very, very strong in Solana. I would like to see how MEV per transaction or the efficient, because there's an efficiency of MEV, right? Right now, like in Solana, if you just like slap market sell or market buy on a Solana DEX and you have like a very high slippage tolerance, like we know that this has been a problem with Solana MEV because people are just like dumping into a DEX with very high slippage tolerance and then MEV validators are taking a very large cut. I would like to see some sort of like MEV efficiency, because if MEVs are taking pennies over a large number of transactions, that's good. If they're taking like hundreds of dollars over a low number of transactions, that's bad.
Why is that bad? It's bad for users?
Super bad for users, and it's just not sustainable. That just means that's an inefficient market.
I think that's kind of like a leading indicator of what will happen if users feel like they're getting jacked up over MEV costs, right? And they're being sandwich attacked, that sort of thing. Like my theory is they just go to another chain where that doesn't happen, right? As part of the kind of the commoditization type story, which would kind of happen. But the meme coins have
to move there because the users will follow the meme coins.
Yeah, that's true. And that, I think, accounts for a lot of this is Solana has absolutely dominated the meme coin narrative this cycle, which has been super, super hot. All right, David, we got a lot more to cover. What's coming up?
Coming up next, Robinhood receives a Wells notice, but they're not giving up. They're joining the pro-crypto army. Biden's got a veto vote for crypto coming, but Trump is taking the opportunity to push back. Crypto is becoming a pretty partisan crypto issue this election cycle. And then Gary is on CNBC talking smack, so we're going to play those videos and comment on them. So you're going to hear all of that and more. But first, a moment to talk about some of these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible. If you want a crypto trading experience backed by world-class security and award-winning support teams, then head over to Kraken, one of the longest-standing and most secure crypto platforms in the world. Kraken is on a journey to build a more accessible, inclusive, and fair financial system, making it simple and secure for everyone, everywhere, to trade crypto. Kraken's intuitive trading tools are designed to grow with you, empowering you to make your first or your 100th trade in just a few clicks. And there's an award-winning client support team available 24/7 to help you along the way, along with a whole range of educational guides, articles, and videos. With products and features like Kraken Pro and Kraken NFT Marketplace and a seamless app to bring it all together, it's really the perfect place to get your complete crypto experience. So check out the simple, secure, and powerful way for everyone to trade crypto, whether you're a complete beginner or a seasoned pro. Go to kraken.com/bankless to see what crypto can be. Not investment advice. Crypto trading involves risk of loss. Celo is the mobile-first, EVM-compatible, carbon-negative blockchain built for the real world, driving real world use cases like mobile payments and mobile DeFi. And with Opera MiniPay as one of the fastest growing Web3 wallets, Celo is seeing a meteoric rise with over 300 million transactions and 1.5 million monthly active addresses. And now Celo is looking to come home to Ethereum as a layer two. Optimism, Polygon, Matter Labs, and Arbitrum have all thrown their hats in the ring for the Celo layer two to build upon their stacks. Why the competition? The Celo layer two will bring huge advantages like a decentralized sequencer, off-chain data availability, secured by Ethereum validators, and one block finality. What does that all mean for you? With Celo Layer 2, gas fees will stay low, and you can even pay for gas natively using ERC20 tokens, sending crypto to phone numbers across wallets using Social Connect. But Celo is a community-governed protocol. This means that Celo needs you to weigh in and make your voice heard. Join the conversation in the Celo forums, follow Celo on Twitter, and visit Celo.org to shape the future of Ethereum. Have you ever felt that the tools for developing decentralized applications are too restrictive and fail to leverage advancements from traditional software programming? There's a wide range of expressive building blocks beyond conventional smart contracts and Solidity development. Don't waste your time building the basics from scratch, and don't limit the potential of your vision. Cartesi provides powerful and scalable solutions for developers that supercharge app development. With a Cartesi virtual machine, you can run a full Linux OS and access decades of rich code libraries and open source tooling for building in Web3. And with Cartesi's unique rollup framework, you'll get real-world scaling and computation. No more competing for block space. So, if you're a developer looking to push the boundaries of what's possible in Web3, Cartesi is now offering up to $50,000 in grants. Head over to Cartesi's grant application page to apply today. And if you're not a developer, those with staked CTSI can take part in the governance process and vote on whether or not a proposal should be funded. Make sure you're vote ready by staking your CTSI before the votes open. Robinhood receives a Wells notice from the SEC, and they are joining the ranks of all the other crypto companies who are now also fighting the SEC. Robinhood says they're just not going down silently. They are going to fight the SEC in the courts. And so Dan Gallagher, Robinhood's CLO's chief legal officer, says, after years of good faith attempts to work with the SEC for regulatory clarity, including our well-known attempt to come in and register, we are disappointed that the agency has decided to issue a Wells notice relating to our U.S. crypto business. Vlad, the CEO and co-founder, says, While we strive to maintain positive and productive relationships with our regulators, if necessary, we will use our resources to contest this matter in courts with the intent of both defending our crypto business and establishing regulatory clarity with the United States for the benefit of our customers. So Gary Gensler and the SEC coming after Robinhood's specifically crypto side of the business. Robinhood, of like of the most compliant and rigorous and constrained
even more
crypto
constrained
suppliers.
And cautious and conservative right. than Coinbase and Kraken.
There's only like 20, 30 like crypto assets on Robinhood, and they got served a Wells notice. And so Robinhood, a very like large and well-resourced company, is once again like joining the crypto army to fight the SEC in court. So LFG.
It's interesting. So this is number five, right, of like the kind of the big names, US-based companies, right? So we've got MetaMask, Consensus, of course. Mm-hmm. We've got Uniswap. We've got Kraken and Coinbase, and now Robinhood. What's interesting is all of the other four companies came directly from like their crypto-native companies, whereas Robinhood right. is fintech, and they're trying to expand mm-hmm. into crypto, and they have done so quite successfully. Right. It's also interesting, Robinhood has a non-custodial wallet. So I bet mm-hmm. that's on the docket for the Wells notice as well. But how did investors react to this, right? Because Robinhood is a publicly traded company and probably has a lot of traditional TradFi types of investors. I mean, did that spook people?
Yeah, so Hood, the equity of Robinhood, had a tiny little blip. I think it went down from $18 down to $17.60 and then right back up to $18. And so there's market fatigue about the SEC Wells notice. Like, the market actually doesn't care about the Gary Gensler and like SEC attack on crypto.
Like, the market's pricing it in, basically? It's nerfed?
Or it's pricing in nothing because they're saying that this is bullshit and it's not going to affect the market.
I mean, Jose says this is the debasement of Wells notices and the SEC's
reputation. That's what happens when you issue Wells notices like candy.
Well, this is what Jake Travinsky says. The SEC just sent a Wells notice to Robinhood. The number they've sent about crypto in recent months is astonishing. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine they would or could bring so many enforcement actions at once. It seems like they're abusing the Wells process as a scare tactic now. This is pretty much unprecedented. I mean, think of all these Wells notices that have been recently sent. We don't even know if we're done. My question, David, is what's the legal theory of this? Like, the SEC is, as you said, dishing out Wells notices like candy, but don't they have to win a case? Mm-hmm. Like,
they don't.
Like, wouldn't the correct normal order of operation be like, do a Wells notice for one company, mm-hmm. see if you win in court based on all crypto assets are security and non-custodial wallets are non-compliant. All of these charges are very similar for each of these companies, right? And then based on that, you'll get a reaction from the market. They'll stop doing it or whatever, and then take the offenders to court. They're not doing that. It's just like a blanket DDoS attack, which right. like makes me think that this is not about winning in court at all. No. This is about creating a chilling effect.
This
like,
is
yeah,
just
we can
about
send...
doing it. They don't care yeah. about the outcome. They just want to do it.
I don't think winning a case is the point here, or maybe it was never the point. So, David, Gary is doing appearances. Whenever he does something like this, he makes an appearance on CNBC, on Squawk Box. And so they want to talk to him about
crypto. Because he's an influencer.
Did you get this? A whole 6-minute video.
Yeah.
And it will both enrage you, but kind of capture his mindset. Here's how it opens. I'm going to play this.
One of the things I wanted to ask you is, when you look at the headlines today around what the SEC is doing and what your priorities are, it's hard to tell how much of your focus today is on the stock market writ large versus the world of crypto and trying to figure out the future of Ethereum and other things. How do you see it?
Well, I see it this way. We oversee $110 trillion capital market. About half of that's the stock market. Half, as you might know, is the bond markets right. and other markets. Crypto is a small
piece
of our overall markets. And but it's an outsized piece of the scams and frauds and problems in our markets, because without prejudging any one token, much of this field is non-compliant with the protections of our securities laws. And so thus, you end up with like an outsized ratio of journalist questions and crypto journalists to market cap.
But is that a function also of the fact that that's where your attention is too?
No, it's a function of where your attention is. Think about it. I've been on your show, what, a dozen times? And every show, you ask about crypto. And my guessing is this will be a majority crypto interview, while the capital markets are $110 trillion. So it's also about where the financial media is focused.
Gaslighting.
See, yeah, this is the tenure of the entire interview, David. And basically, Gary is very triggered that he's being asked crypto questions. And the interviewer's right. like, you're being asked crypto questions because you're dropping Wells notices.
Yeah.
Like, that's... the SEC doesn't usually do this. And you just dropped one on Robinhood. So he goes on to quote what Vlad, the CEO of Robinhood, said against the SEC. And Gary is just like increasingly frustrated this entire time that they keep focusing on crypto. But it's because he is disproportionately focusing on attacking crypto.
Dude, this is just like, you know, the Leslie Nielsen gif from Naked Gun where there's like the exploding building behind him and he's like, nothing to see here, please disperse.
All right,
God, this is an insane level of gaslighting.
I want to play this other clip from the interview too because I think it's relevant. Here it is. It's Gary on disclosures in crypto.
The field of crypto assets, without prejudging any one of them, many of those tokens are securities under the law of the land, as interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court. So we follow that law. And you, the investors, are not getting the required or needed disclosures about those assets. And so, like, this is earnings season right now, Andrew. Mm-hmm. Everybody's asking about what's the earnings release and how many companies are beating earnings or falling behind and so forth. Where is the disclosures from these crypto tokens similar to... Right.
I don't know how many times we have to say this, but the catch 22 of Gary Gensler saying there's no, like, all of the investor protections around crypto assets are terrible. Like, there's no disclosures around crypto assets. Investors are getting the raw end of the deal. That's what we're saying about the meta, the points meta that people have been forced into, cornered into, because you cannot come in and register. He is creating the reality that he is complaining about. This whole line of, without prejudging any one of them, many of the tokens are securities under the law of the land as interpreted by the Supreme Court. No, bro. As interpreted by you, you're just using the Supreme Court as your scapegoat. The Supreme Court is saying this. Like, no, you're saying this.
David.
And then he's saying, like, there aren't sufficient disclosures from these tokens. What the actual F? If any team actually made any sort of, like, disclosure about, like, here's what a token gets you, here are the rights that a token gets you, they're going to get the ban hammer from Gary Gensler. It's just the biggest, most gaslighting catch-22 that I've ever fucking seen. Excuse my language.
It's so gaslighting, and it's even worse than what you're saying. He's not acknowledging the superior disclosures that crypto already has. The interviewer goes on to ask him about Ethereum, right? And of course, he doesn't like answering any questions. Well, let's talk about Ethereum. Gary says Ethereum and all crypto assets don't have disclosures. Here's the reality. Ethereum issues a decentralized earnings report. He was talking about earnings season. A earnings report every 12 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
You can see it all.
And anybody with an internet connection can audit this. Anyone can access it. It's completely open source. You can see literally how much revenue is going to validators and, like, the profit on this revenue. This is also true of many DeFi protocols that, like, you can see that the cash flows on chain. This is better than a quarterly earnings report. It's like real-time data. And instead of the SEC going to Ethereum, just connecting, they have this database for all of those disclosures. It's called the Edgar database, right? Where all of the filings are listed. If you're a company, if you're a security, you have to disclose there. Why don't they just go connect the Edgar database to an Ethereum node? Right? They could, the disclosures are freaking there. It's like, this is the gaslighting, David. It was never about disclosures. It's just not about disclosures.
It's
not about protecting investors. It's about control. And it always was about control.
The industry.
And he might think he can gaslight kind of like the trad users who just don't have never been to Dune Analytics, like can't actually go to token terminal.
Oh, frauds in crypto? Oh, I've heard of those.
He can't gaslight FTX. Us though. I'm like, I prefer these earnings reports to the quarterly things that I get from the SEC. It's like real time, open source.
Investor.
Oh, wow. We could go on, David, but that's not all this week.
It gets worse. The Biden administration has made a statement of administration policy saying that they strongly oppose the passage of House Resolution Bill 109. Ryan, what is this? What's 109? What's going on here?
Yeah, basically, this is Biden saying that they are going to veto this House Resolution Bill. Okay.
And there's a bill in the House.
Yeah, this is a bill in the House. We'll get to that in a second. But I think that this is the most explicit FU that we've seen from the Biden administration directly against crypto. It's like most of the time it's been through kind of like the SEC or FinCEN, Treasury, all of these things. This is Biden actually saying, hey, if this legislation comes to my desk, I will veto it. So let's talk about it. Let's give some background on this because House Resolution 109, like, what is this? Okay, so the background context right now is today, in today's environment, U.S. banks can't really custody crypto. The reason why, I don't know if people know this, but it's because about 2 years ago, so this is March in 2022, the SEC, again, it's Gary, the SEC pushed through an obscure accounting rule. This was called SAB 102. And in the words of the banks, this is the bank saying that, this is not me, SAB 102 effectively precludes banks from offering digital asset custody at scale, since placing the value of client assets on their balance sheet will impact certain capital, liquidity, and other prudential requirements. It basically means no U.S. bank can custody crypto, because if they do, they have to like house all of the reserves. It messes up their accounting. It basically is a loophole to make it impossible for banks to custody assets. And there's two notes on this that are important going into this. This is not how any other asset is treated. For custodians, there's all sorts of custodial assets out there, from like property, rentals, securities, all of these things. This accounting requirement is not required for any other thing other than digital assets, other than crypto, right? Because that would be crazy. It's like the custodial service is sort of a known thing. So this is an exclusion for crypto. And also, the way the SEC did this back in March 2022 was sneaky, like over-the-top sneaky. They didn't do administrative procedural rulemaking. You don't rulemaking with commentary. That's what the law requires, right? They didn't like sneaky a backdoor way, and they just pushed it in. So what's happening right now, David, in real time, is Congress caught wind of all of this, the SAB 102 thing, because they didn't really realize what was going on. You know, they're busy. They're focusing on many things, I suppose. And they're trying to reverse it. Okay, so they're trying to reverse SAB 102. That's the House resolution that you just mentioned, and that's what's being that's what's in front of Congress right now. And then this is Biden saying, "Hey, if you guys pass this in Congress, if it gets through the House and Senate, I will veto it." And the Biden administration says he would veto it because it would disrupt the SEC's work to protect investors in crypto assets markets and to safeguard the broader financial system. So that's the reason he's giving to veto it. So what's happening right now is this bill is in the House. It actually, just as of yesterday, it passed. So it passed the House. You got to pass the House, and then it goes to the Senate.
And we want it to pass. We like passing. Good for us.
We want it to pass just because, like, banks are private institutions. They should have the ability to custody crypto assets as well.
What do banks do? Banks custody stuff.
Yeah, obviously, we favor bankless, custody of your own keys, but there are situations where you want a custodial service to house your private keys, and that's okay too. We don't want an operation choke point type of situation. Anyway, this passed, and look at the numbers here. 207 Republicans in the House and 21 Democrats. What's significant is actually the number of Democrats that voted for this. Right. Because they have to go very much against the Elizabeth Warren party line.
That's 21 Democrats that defected from the party lines of the establishment Democrats.
Yes, basically.
This is Jake Stravinsky, who's commenting, SAB 121 is illogical and illegal. The SEC adopted it in violation of the CRA and APA for no reason other than to harm the crypto industry. The White House should have walked away from this mess instead of doubling down on attacking U.S. companies. Not smart. In an election year. So this goes back to our episode that we did with a lot of people gave us like great feedback on this one episode with Joe Lubin and the consensus case against the SEC, where Joe Lubin is just putting on just like saying the quiet part out loud. Like, this is a conspiracy to just completely suppress crypto out of the Biden administration. And in an election year, Biden is saying, hey, like, just we're doing the full suppression. Like, no, you don't enter crypto assets into our traditional financial system. Banks, I know your guys' one job is to custody stuff, but you can't custody crypto. We are enforcing that choice upon you. And then meanwhile, Gary Gensler, like an arm of the Biden administration, is issuing Wells notices to any company that touches crypto. So it's just a full suppression of the industry.
Well, and here's the thing that doesn't make sense to me is, why are they doing this before November, right? Even if Biden loses the election, I mean, he's still in office after November. Why not like pass it then?
Because like who is the marginal voter that's like, oh, Biden is suppressing the crypto industry, I'm going to vote for him because of that.
Exactly.
Who is that voter?
So I asked Jake Chervinsky this question, like, what are they thinking over there? Why are they going full Kim Jong-un on crypto before November? How does this make sense? And Jake's take is it's an exercise in partisan wagging circling. The administration can't admit the SEC has done anything wrong, and the Democrats have to oppose the Republicans. So
this is so dumb.
It's okay, super dumb.
So let's get into the Trump response to this, because Trump was asked a crypto question about like how his approach to crypto is. And you can just tell it is a direct response, like, oh, the Democrats don't like crypto. Well, therefore, I like it.
Yeah.
And you should vote for me because of it.
Let's play this.
Let's play the video, yeah.
Biden doesn't even know what it is. If you ask Biden, sir, are you for or against crypto? What's that? What the? Get me off the stage. He's saying, get me off the stage. No, he has no idea. But look, Gensler is very much against it. The Democrats are very much against it. And I say this, a lot of people are very much for it, probably a lot of the people in this group. And I'm fine with it. I want to make sure it's good and solid and everything else, but I'm good with it. And if you like crypto in any form, and it comes in a lot of different forms, if you're in favor of crypto, you better vote for
Trump. So, David, what that does is this makes crypto an election issue.
Yep.
And this is back to...
And they just gave Trump the silver platter of, like, the crypto single-issue voter. If you are a crypto single-issue voter, like, Biden wants to ban it. Gary Gensler wants to ban it. Gary Gensler is Biden. And Trump just said, like, well, he doesn't even have to follow through on supporting it. He just has to not ban it.
100%. It's just the game theory of it. If the Democrats are saying one thing
for the Trump administration,
he's going to go to the other side and try to get votes and try to appeal to this demographic. And the question of can you trust Trump or not to like follow through his promise? It doesn't even matter at this point in time. Yeah. It's become an election issue and it's going to be a piece of it. I mean, this leads to the question that a lot of people are asking is like, okay, what happened here? Like, do the Democrats hate crypto? We've kind of seen the trajectory of this a little bit. And one thing I'll just say to people is like, not all Democrats hate crypto. You can actually go to the Coinbase Stand with Crypto website, which is fantastic. And you like sort by Democrats and their stance on crypto as like pro crypto, and you can see a lot of folks here, like a lot of we've talked to members of Congress. Richie Torres is a Democrat who is in favor of crypto, so it's definitely not all of them, but it does seem to be a strong contingent, particularly with access into the executive branch of the Biden White House, the anti-crypto army led by Elizabeth Warren, that are really pushing down these positions. So
it's the establishment Democrats. It's the incumbent Democrats.
I don't even know if we know where Biden like truly stands on this issue.
Think Biden cares. I don't think he has an opinion on it.
So in the absence of not having a strong opinion, right, that decision kind of gets delegated to the Elizabeth Warrens of the world and the anti-crypto army, right?
And so this is where Joe Lubin says the banking sector, the incumbents have found their wedge into the political sphere through the Elizabeth Warren incumbent Democrats types have the ear of Biden.
That's right. And it is interesting you say wedge, because it is a wedge issue. I think some people will just say, well, like, okay, sure, the Bankless podcast cares about these issues, and there are like some like greater than 0% of single issue crypto voters, but really it's not going to swing any election, right? This doesn't matter. And that's why they're doing it. So like they can do all of this stuff because they know crypto voters don't participate or don't care. Or there's not enough of them. There's actually some interesting data on that that's been put out last week by Paradigm. Really interesting poll that fills in some blanks. Basically, 31% of voters, this is a poll for just swing states, like the states that matter for Biden. If 31% of votes in the swing states are crypto positive, and 40% of them say it's a major issue. So if you kind of distill that, that's about 12% of the electorate overall is crypto positive and also says it's a major issue for them. Wow. So 12% is not small, David.
No, that's huge, dude. I kind of didn't expect that. This is a poll coming out of the Blockchain Association, so there's a conflict of neutrality there.
For sure.
But like still... If that is at all directionally correct.
What if it's 5%? What if it's like...
It was 5%, I would still be impressed.
Well, because some of the elections in some of these swing states are going to be so tight. So to me, this is like a complete cell phone move.
This is a huge blunder
by the Democrats. And I guess crypto just became an election issue, and we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah. Yeah, this is these are facts and circumstances that I will not be bringing up with my family.
What do we got coming up?
Coming up next, token launches. FriendTech, Mode all launched their token. We got an update on the Eigenlayer stake drops, some new details there. And then, did FTX creditors do better than holding ETH this cycle?
No, because they're doing so.
Say it ain't so. We'll talk about what the hell that meant. All of that and more. But first, a moment to talk about these fantastic sponsors that make this show possible, especially Mantle, a preferred yield-bearing layer 2. If you haven't explored the Mantle ecosystem, there's a link in the show notes so you can get started. Mantle, formerly known as BitDAO, is the first DAO-led Web3 ecosystem, all built on top of Mantle's first core product, the Mantle Network, a brand new high-performance Ethereum layer 2 built using the OP stack, but uses EigenLayer's data availability solution instead of the expensive Ethereum layer 1. Not only does this reduce Mantle Network's gas fees by 80%, but it also reduces gas fee volatility, providing a more stable foundation for Mantle's applications. The Mantle Treasury is one of the biggest DAO-owned treasuries, which is seeding an ecosystem of projects from all around the Web3 space for Mantle. Mantle already has sub-communities from around Web3 onboarded, like Game 7 for Web3 gaming, and Bybit for TVL and liquidity and on-ramps. So if you want to build on the Mantle network, Mantle is offering a grants program that provides milestone-based funding to promising projects that help expand, secure, and decentralize Mantle. If you want to get started working with the first DAO-led Layer 2 ecosystem, check out Mantle at mantle.xyz and follow them on Twitter at 0xmantle. Taking self-custody of your crypto is one of the most important things you can do on your bankless journey. It's also one of the hardest things to get right, with huge consequences if you don't. If you want help going bankless, talk to Casa. Casa helps you take custody of your crypto assets so you don't have to wonder whether you're doing it right. Casa is a one-stop shop for doing self-custody the right way. With Casa Vaults, you can hold Ether, Bitcoin, stablecoins, all with one simple app and multiple keys for the ultimate peace of mind, with a support team to help you every step of the way. But it doesn't stop at self-custody, because even though crypto is forever, you are not. We all plan on making life-changing wealth in crypto, but with Casa's inheritance product, life-changing wealth can elevate to generational wealth for your kids and your loved ones who don't know anything about crypto. With Casa, you won't lose your private keys and you won't accidentally take them to the grave either. Click the link in the description to get started securing your generational wealth. Launching a token? Worried about the IRS? Talk to Toku for 5 minutes to learn how to save hundreds of thousands of dollars for you, your team, and your investors. Now, if you do an initial consultation, Toku will cover the cost of your token valuation, which is what you need for your launch. So don't wait, reach out to the team right now at team@toku.com. That's team@toku.com. Arbitrum is the leading Ethereum scaling solution that is home to hundreds of decentralized applications. Arbitrum's technology allows you to interact with Ethereum at scale with low fees and faster transactions. Arbitrum has the leading DeFi ecosystem, strong infrastructure options, flourishing NFTs, and is quickly becoming the Web3 gaming hub. Explore the ecosystem at portal.arbitrum.io. Are you looking to permissionlessly launch your own Arbitrum Orbit chain? Arbitrum Orbit allows anyone to utilize Arbitrum's secure scaling technology to build your own Orbit chain, giving you access to interoperable, customizable permissions with dedicated throughput. Whether you are a developer, an enterprise, or a user, Arbitrum Orbit lets you take your project to new heights. All of these technologies leverage the security and decentralization of Ethereum. Experience Web3 development the way it was always meant to be: secure, fast, cheap, and friction-free. Visit arbitrum.io and get your journey started in one of the largest Ethereum communities. FTX creditors will make 118% on their dollar.
Wait,
of
what?
Their claims.
Really?
Yep, that's right. Yeah. So if you have, if you lost $1 in FTX, you'll be getting $1.18 back. Did you beat ETH this cycle? No, but it's kind of a joke because you, you probably got pretty close. And so because of the asset appreciation and because of like the actual strong recovery of assets by the just like the new administration of FTX, they are getting more money than what they owe creditors. And so if you're a creditor, you're getting an extra 18 cents on your dollar.
You know what's crazy is, you know, the people administering this bankruptcy, they find this unbelievable. They're like, this never happens. How is this even possible? Right?
Uh-huh.
Like the bankruptcy procedures are basically
only in crypto.
Yeah.
Only in crypto.
How do you dispense cents on the dollar to all of the creditors? And in this case, they're able to give 118%. And the reason it's 118% is because with interest. And of course, what this means is like, are you making your money back? You're making it back in fiat terms. So it's as if Sam Bankman-Fried in November of 2022, if you were a depositor into FTX, he just market sold all your assets.
Right.
And you're getting the proceeds of that back.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But you're not getting like if you had Sol or if you had Ether.
Do you have to pay taxes on the appreciation of your claims?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, you always have to pay taxes, David.
But if you had your money stolen from you and then it returned at a higher level, you have to pay taxes on the difference?
Yeah, on that delta. It's net income to you. Yeah, unless you have a boating accident.
We don't have this in the agenda, but there's something about this FTX case that has caused ruffled feathers is that the lawyers, the people managing the estate of the FTX, are being paid $1.5 billion in fees.
Oh.
And so, like, there's a conspiracy here. Is that, like, they are touting around, like, yeah, we're giving 118% of, like, clean people's claims back.
Sure.
Good job, us, but also we're paying ourselves.
Well, I don't know what to say about that, but they have sort of treated this as a hedge fund in a way. Like, it's all about timing. Uh-huh. I mean, bankruptcy proceedings are slow, but if they had sold the assets, say, sometime in 2023, you wouldn't get this kind of outcome. So they've been, like, strategically selling the assets and, like, managing it fairly well, I suppose. Like, it could be worse. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's worth $1.5 billion, but I guess that's the nature of crypto.
That's a hot take. All right, moving on to Frentech. Frentech launched their token last week, kind of just coming back after being pretty quiet for a number of months since the Frentech mania kind of ended, along with a token, Frentech V2, with a couple of new features, clubs. So there could be a club now. So instead of having like owning the keys of one particular person, keys of a club can be made. There's a native DEX inside of Frentech. So they have a Frentech native AMM, which is where all of the Frentech token is getting its liquidity from. And then, of course, inside of the app, you liquidity providers who provide ETH and Frentech liquidity to this AMM are getting 1.5% in fees as well. And so this what's interesting here is just like you're seeing the vertical integration. This is all on Base, but Frentech, the app, is also got its own DEX, and so it's getting some just more infrastructure. Frentech token coming in just under $2 right now. That brings it to a fully diluted valuation of $178 million, which I think is pretty, like, it's not over its ski tips. $178 million in comparison to, like, the high FDV low float tokens that are out there, pretty damn
fair.
Well,
because, 100% of the supply went to users, basically, the community. Is this true or not?
Yeah, there wasn't a blog post. I couldn't really figure out like the distribution, but apparently 100% of Frentech tokens got sent out to the people that of like, users of Frentech.
I claimed mine and it was okay. It was kind of a clunky experience, I got to say, but it was okay. And but I do think that this token, this chart is one to watch of like Frentech because this is almost going to be a bellwether for other SocialFi types of applications and the narrative around it. So it's definitely an interesting one to watch.
Yeah, certainly. The other thing that's interesting about this is that Frentech has been very popular with like the trader influencers out there. But when you claim your Frentech tokens, it goes to an account that everyone knows is yours. And so everyone can see people when they choose to sell their Frentech. And so like there's been this like people are shilling their Frentech, but then they're also dumping it at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And now for the first time, people can see the relationship between
their favorite influencers dumping
their
on
favorite
them.
Influencers, what they're saying in public versus what they're doing in private. Now we totally know this. So that's been a fun game to watch.
It's disclosures, Gary Gensler. We got them.
disclosures. Okay, moving on to the EigenLayer stake drop update. This happened on the Friday right after we recorded last week. So 100 additional Eigen tokens are being allocated to every single wallet. So every single wallet is getting 100 Eigen tokens. The minimum that you could have gotten before this update was 10. And so in addition to this 100, now the minimum you're getting is 110.
Raising the floor.
Raising the floor for everyone, yeah. Also, just some clarity. Investor vesting, I said this last week, so roll up, this was just like a miscommunication. Just people made an assumption that investor vesting started before Eigen transferability started. That's not true. And they just made a clarifying statement that investor vesting of the Eigen token does not begin until Eigen is transferable. And then they provided some more clarity about the transferability targeted date, which is around September. Claiming will go live the day that people are listening to this, Friday the 10th of May. So we're going to start to see like how many people, if they are motivated to get around the claiming VPN block. But all of that information is going to be surfaced on crypto Twitter for people who are watching.
Yeah, I don't have any more takes on this. I feel like we've talked this one to death. I will just notice that people seem pretty happy about this. And
the response was good.
Yeah, like the anger about this has completely subsided. You know, like portion that was real of that anger and also the portion that was maybe like airdrop farmers.
Yeah. Yeah. Not the only token. So Mode introduced its token, Mode Network. It is an OP stack superchain chain. If you aren't really familiar with Mode is, it's basically like a superchain version of Blast. Blast also an OP stack, but not inside of the superchain. Mode is inside of the superchain. And so there's just a bunch of like incentivized growth.
David, being in the superchain, does that provide you any like benefit right now? Or it's more of a social benefit with the promise of future integration benefit, yes?
The biggest benefit is you get involved inside of Optimism OP retroactive public goods funding, which is like people right now on Blast are farming Blast gold. But Mode, as a part of the superchain, like doing things on Mode rewards you with like OP grants and a variety of different things.
But the hope is for more than that. The hope is that superchain
That's what's happening today.
Becomes more of an economic zone, right? Where everything is composable and synchronous. And that's got to be what Optimism is working towards, yes?
Yeah, they haven't released details yet, but like I think there's some like people is kind of flying under the radar. I think Optimism is not immediately soon, but they're going to drop some like pretty damn cool like both the scaling and composability innovations.
Well, I actually just want to skip ahead while we're talking about Optimism. I saw this post, didn't get a chance to get into it, from Optimism welcoming L3s to the superchain. This is from Optimism. What are they saying with respect to L3s? So there are already L3s built on the superchain, right? We've talked about DGEN, which is kind of built on Base.
It's built on top of Base, and Base is a part of the superchain.
Yeah.
But I don't know if DGEN is, because DGEN is built using Arbitrum Orbits. And in order to be part of the superchain, you need to be under the same like tech stack. You need to be using the OP stack.
Okay, so what is this? What is an L3 on the superchain?
Yeah, so they're giving their like roadmap to how you can be an L3 on Optimism and also be a part of the superchain. There's two main different like innovations here that are differentiated from just a typical OP stack fork, which is like Mode Network and Base and all the other ones. So there's this thing called Plasma Mode, which is like an alternative version of a data availability layer. They've been working on Plasma, which is a very old technical innovation that is being resurfaced as a data availability layer. Extremely cheap. Like I think probably like theoretically minimum cost for data availability. And then also custom gas tokens. So famously DGEN, the DGEN chain uses the DGEN token as a gas token. And so these are the new features that are being brought into what could be a layer three construction to really allow for a very strong layer three construction. Like if you're going to build a layer three, you need to be super, super fast, super, super quick. And then you're also going to want to use your own token as a gas. And so these primitives are being standardized so it can be brought into the super chain.
David, also something we've been covering is Bitcoin layer twos. We did this episode with Eric Wall, which I absolutely love. If you want to go deep on Bitcoin layer twos and what's real, what's not, you got to go check that out. But something released last week that we didn't catch or we didn't include in the roll up. And this is Bob, the Bob chain built on Bitcoin. It's a layer two in air quotes. So it's not quite a layer two, but it is using the OP stack. And the social commitment is to transition to being secured by Bitcoin when BitVM as a technology matures, and they're able to do that. So they're growing this with, it's like a platypus, because they're growing this with Ethereum, in quotes, technology, like, you know, like fork of the OP stack. And then eventually they want to use Bitcoin as the settlement layer. Now, I think we're going to see a lot of experimentation in the Bitcoin layer two world around this, and it's pretty exciting. Also, I haven't had a chance to listen to your episode. It's right now, it's on the Bankless premium feed. So if you are a Bankless citizen, you already have this. It's in my queue to go listen to. But this is around autonomous world, something that you are super excited about. I did notice that there was this chain called Redstone that was deployed, and this is a layer two, but it's focused on autonomous worlds. Tell me about Redstone and just pill us on the autonomous worlds like concept if you can.
Yeah, so now actually we're moving back into the OP stack and the superchain. Redstone is an OP stack layer two. It's actually developed downstream from the actual first ever forking of the OP stack. If people remember OP Mud or OP Craft, which was a Minecraft version of it was an OP stack fork that ran Minecraft. Autonomous Worlds is a category of Ethereum development that I actually think is Ethereum's main quest line, which is why I'm so bullish on it.
You think it's super big. You think this is
like the logical conclusion of where Ethereum goes. Ethereum, when it starts, it first starts at DeFi. It ends at autonomous worlds. And so this is what this episode about is about with Justin Glibert from the Lattice team. Lattice is an OP stack construction. Think of it like an operating system for building autonomous worlds on an OP stack chain. An autonomous world is kind of synonymous with a fully on-chain game. So a game with all of the logic put on chain. No logic is left external. Like there's no external dependencies. Physics, assets, like the laws of the world are all coded on chain. And this is why they need that plasma mode that I was talking about earlier with just like extremely cheap, basically zero data availability costs. And then also they have like an operating system that they're calling Lattice that they're building on top of Redstone. And so this is so experimental. This is so early in this whole like autonomous worlds thing. But like the degree of which I think this is, it's hard to understate. This is the main point of Ethereum. This is the logical conclusion of Ethereum. It's basically what is actually really the promised metaverse. But I'll let people who listen to the podcast episode like unpack that take when they listen.
Well, in order to get that episode, you got to be on the Bankless Premium feed. And by the way, and we are glowing up the Bankless Premium feed. It's now available on Spotify. It's awesome. It's some bonus exclusive episodes further in the frontier. There's actually a code that I want to give today. It's in the show notes, but feed 10. It gives you a 10% discount on a Bankless. 10. Yeah, feed, F-E-E-D 10. I don't know how long that's going to last, but go check out that episode as I'm going to. It's in my queue.
Okay, we're hopping around left and right this week. Now we're back into the world of nation states and their relationship with crypto, but this time not inside of the United States. This time we're talking about Nigeria. What's going on in Nigeria, Ryan? And why is this relevant to crypto?
Well, David, it seems like some capital controls are hitting Nigeria. So Nigeria has a version of the SEC, and they are proposing some... There's been a crackdown on Binance right now, on just like in general crypto and exchanges. Now there's some legislation like that they're looking to pass that would actually ban peer-to-peer crypto transactions. And why? It's basically because the threat of like crypto trading against the Nigerian currency. And I say this to say, like, you know, people hearing this will say, well, that's in Nigeria. Like, I live in, you know, someplace in Europe, or I live in Australia, or I live in the US. Like, how's that going to affect me? I feel like the example that we're seeing in Nigeria of capital controls is just kind of like front running what is possible in your, you know, local liberal, Western liberal democracy with like a mature, system. When you get into a situation where the local currency is under threat from money printing. We talked about this at length in an episode that we just recorded, I think it's coming out on Monday with Lynn Alden. There's an entire section there on capital controls and what could happen when a country gets into a situation like the 1930s in the US and like, I guess, worldwide, where there are threats to the nation state currency from some sort of non-sovereign asset. In that case, it was gold. The next case, it could be crypto. So I feel like I'm watching this in Nigeria.
You're saying this is a canary in the coal mine.
It's a canary in the coal mine. I feel like they're front running something really ugly that could happen in other places around the world. I would actually be interested in talking to somebody like from the crypto community in Nigeria, do a Bankless episode to just like see what it's like on the ground, because I think this is incredibly important to
You're saying like the weakness of a fiat currency is going to be a harbinger of capital controls for any. So like if you are living in a country with a weak currency, you're likely to see capital controls around crypto sooner rather than later, is what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying, David. But let's not end on that, okay? Let's end on some good news.
Yeah. This is actually kind of a big deal. Revolut, which is a very big payment provider, I think mainly focusing on Europe, has introduced Revolut X. I guess we love naming things X these days. A cryptocurrency-tailored exchange. So Revolut, a trad European-based payment provider, has introduced a crypto exchange to, I would assume, to help facilitate foreign exchange transfers and actually like exchanging currencies.
It's really cool. Have you ever used Revolut, David?
No, I haven't. Not in forever.
It's like Venmo. It's kind of a Venmo type experience, only it's, you know, like much more European focused.
And much bigger, right? Like much more of like a kind of a common standard to use in Europe.
Yeah, I think it's a very big deal in many places in Europe. So expanding into crypto the way Robinhood did.
Yeah, that's a pretty big deal, especially for European listeners. So congrats on the dub, European listeners. Bankless Nation, that was the weekly roll up. Thank you for running through the weekly news with us. We got a meme of the week to leave you with. This is from John Wu, which is the classic bell curve meme, but I actually helped. I think this is a great... synthesis of what the bell curve meme actually is. Of course, you have, you know, the left and the right side of the curves, and then you have like the frustrated man in the middle. The left and right side of the curves labeled as practice here, and then the frustrated man in the middle labeled as theory. I actually really appreciate this because I think like the whole point about being on the margins of the curve is actually you're putting your money where your mouth is, and you're not just theorizing things, but you're putting things into practice. Hmm. And you're actually taking risks. You're actually like in the trenches. You're actually taking real learning lessons, not just theorizing about stuff. So appreciate the meme.
100%. And that is a timeless lesson from Bankless, of course. We've always encouraged, like, in order to understand what to invest in crypto, you actually have to use the apps. You have to use the system. You have to be on the frontier and do stuff in crypto. And crypto pays you to learn about crypto, not just in
air drops. Even if you lose money, you gain less.
100%. This is like timeless.
Which is,
I think,
not cope.
How come I'm always stuck in the middle and like being frustrated with theory, though, David? This is not cope. All right, guys, we'll end with this. Risks and disclaimers, of course. You know, crypto is risky. You could lose what you put in, but we are headed west. This is the frontier. It's not for everyone, but we're glad you're with us on the Bankless journey. See you later.